Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The other day, while sitting in my backyard, I looked up to the most ordinary of sights where I live, a couple of turkey vultures soaring in lazy circles overhead. I get excited when I see a bald eagle, but when it's the vultures, it's kind of ho-hum because they're always there. But then I took time to really watch them fly and marveled at the tiny wing adjustments they make and how effortlessly they soar. The next day, I saw a group of them feeding on a deer carcass, a roadkill that someone had thankfully dragged off the road and into an adjoining field. And that got me thinking, these are really amazing birds that serve a vital purpose in nature. What are they really like, and what kinds of lives do they lead? I had no idea, but my curiosity was sparked. I wanted to learn more about vultures and their kind, and, of course, the magnificent Californian Andean condors that are their more majestic cousins, so I turned to my friends at UC Davis, and they connected me with our guest for this episode. She's Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, and truly an expert guide to these underappreciated but fascinating birds. She joins us now. Michelle Hawkins, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. And we're going to talk today about vultures specifically. But before we do that, I'd like to find out a bit about you, because, you know, being the director of the Raptor Center, that's a pretty cool gig. And I love that your name is Hawkins on top of that. I'm sure that's not been, you know, lost on you over the years, or people have pointed that out. But tell us about your path to studying raptors.
Sure. Well, I'm a veterinarian as well, and I did my residency at the University of California, Davis, and the California Raptor Center just turned 50 in 2022. And so even back in the dark ages of my residency, the Raptor Center was there. And so I was able to work with the birds, and I just became really fascinated. Where I grew up, my family weren't outdoor people. We didn't go camping, you know, that hiking, that kind of stuff. And so the natural world came to me later in my life. And moving to California from North Carolina and finding all the amazing animals that are out here that weren't necessarily in Charlotte, North Carolina, but I also didn't look for them there. And I just really got engaged during my residency and started bird watching for them as well as caring for them. And then I was very, very lucky to get a faculty position and be able to come back on as faculty and the director of the Raptor Center. I came on director in 2012.
And briefly, what kind of work does the Raptor Center do?
So our mission is to preserve and protect birds of prey, especially those from the Western U.S. And we do that through rehabilitating the birds, through education, and through science. So those are our three major kind of cogs that we work from. And it's really wonderful being on the campus because of the educational component. We have not only veterinary students and veterinary residents still, but we also have undergraduates and graduate students involved with us, as well as members of the general public. So we have a pretty broad age range of volunteers that are there, all of them coming with very different backgrounds, many extremely knowledgeable about birds of prey. So I'm very thankful to have had great teams. I've learned a lot from them, and then I've helped to teach them a little bit about the medicine side.
Very cool. And I love raptors. They're just such magnificent birds. And this morning I saw a bald eagle fly over our house and a couple, a red-tailed hawk who's nesting not too far away.
That's wonderful.
And looking out my window right now, I see some turkey vultures.
Oh, how could that be? Really?
They are always out my window. I can always see them. And that's why I got interested in this, because they're so ubiquitous, and I see them all the time, and I take them for granted, and I always think, oh, there's a bald eagle, and I get very excited. I don't get as excited when I see turkey vultures, and I'm thinking, well, I should learn more about them, because they're important birds, and we tend to dismiss them as not being pretty and magnificent or all those things. So I'm dedicating this show to our vulture friends, and I'm hoping you'll help me.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's start out with, are vultures birds of prey? Are they actually raptors?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the vultures, depending upon what you read, are classified as birds of prey. In fact, they are taxonomically within the same group that includes the eagles, the falcons, and the hawks. However, they're really scavenging birds, and there's differences in their anatomy that really show the difference between the two. They don't kill their prey. They eat things that are already dead. You know, raptors have these impressive claws called talons that press into the prey so they can have a good purchase as they're flying back to a perching place so they can eat their meal. Vultures have flat feet without talons, but like most raptors, they do have a sharpened beak tip, and it helps both of them to be able to rip into their prey and get small enough bites to eat.
And an osprey just flew by, so I think they know you're here. They're all like, oh, Dr. Hawkins is on. Let's cruise by Dave's window. Okay, let's talk about the vultures and condors. Condors are part of the same family, right?
Yeah, they are. They're the largest type of vulture. And so again, these names go back and forth. One of the book chapters I wrote recently was on lead poisoning. And the editors wanted it to be lead poisoning in birds of prey. And I said, no, the title really should be lead poisoning in birds of prey and in scavenging birds, because these birds, just their what they do in the environment is so very different that even though they're classified with the other, with the birds of prey, really, I think that they'll get split out over time. There's been a lot of back and forth over the years. And for right now, at least, they're still ensconced in that area of being associated with raptors.
And how long, you know, in terms of evolution, have these types of scavenging birds been with us?
Well, they have been around for a very long time. If I'm not mistaken, there were depictions of them in some ancient Egyptian pyramids. But I'd have to go back and find out a little bit, you know, find a little bit more to that. But that's a story that I have heard. Having said that, though, you know, for the last at least 500, 600, 700 years, they are very well represented in the literature. And so they've been around, I think, for a very long time. I think that evolutionarily, though, that there had been changes, hence some of these splitting of division of labor, so to speak, between the birds.
And the vultures of Europe, the old world vultures,
yes,
and the new world vultures, they're different, but they've what, convergently evolved so that they're similar?
Yeah, and I mean, really, the old worlds and the new worlds are often called that specifically because of their geographic areas. So when you talk about vultures specifically, here in the United States, we have the turkey vulture and we have black vultures as well. Whereas the vultures and condors, a number of condors throughout Asia, are, you know, to me and in what I understand about them, they're very, very similar animals in terms of their anatomy and how they go about, you know, how they go about getting their food.
And what are some of the misconceptions that people have about these types of birds? We tend to think of them as, oh, gross, you know, they just eat dead things. But they're important to ecosystems, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. When I was younger, you know, remember, there's always cartoons depicting vultures hanging around.
Yeah, I remember a specific Bugs Bunny cartoon where he's out in the desert and he's going to die and the vultures are. And I remember that scared the heck out of me when I was a little kid. And I was thinking about that cartoon when I was getting ready to talk to you.
Well, that's exactly right. And those things scared me as well. I think mine was a Far Side commercial, which I was just too young to get the joke at that time. But yeah, it scared me. And I think has scared many other people and getting a negative feeling about the birds. But like I said, I didn't really know much about these birds specifically until I moved out here to California. And when I got out here, I started seeing so many turkey vultures everywhere. And then, of course, I've been seeing them as patients to boot at the California Raptor Center. Their defense mechanism is to regurgitate whatever is nasty and smelly that they've eaten And it's a really effective strategy. Nobody wants to be the first one in front of that vulture when they come into the clinic.
Oh, okay. That is gross.
Yeah. So, you know, again, this is something that it's not just my generation, but the two generations or so that have come after me are still kind of growing up with that same mentality about these birds. And in the United States, it's not as important as it is in some of the Asian countries where cattle are sacred, for example. And when they die on the range, they leave them there for the vultures and the condors to be able to eat the flesh. And it cleans up the environment and it provides a food source for the animals. So in those countries, it's considered a very win-win, and they often really are less afraid of theirs than we are here in North America. And in fact, unfortunately, I see a lot of gunshot wounds coming in because people think that for whatever reasons, that they shouldn't be on their properties.
Yeah, and they provide such a valuable service cleaning those carcasses. I know, you know, I see them a lot when there's a roadkill. There's always going to be turkey vultures around, you know, feasting on that. And I imagine there's some mortality from them getting hit by cars, too, because of that. But they really do provide a very valuable service in cleaning things up. They're a part of nature's plan to keep everything working.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, but I think that farmers thought that at one point they would kill their livestock or maybe kill their poultry. So they would shoot them. And perhaps that's been passed down to other generations. That and trophy hunting, unfortunately, are what brought down the California condor to the brink of extinction.
Okay, let's talk about some of their interesting adaptations. When people see vultures, you know, soaring and circling, they kind of automatically think, oh, they're circling over a dead thing. But that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, it's not. Actually, they're just amazing at being gliding birds as opposed to having to actively flap their wings every time because of their wingspans. In the turkey vultures, for example, which are often around 6 feet, they don't have to flap as many times as, say, a red-tailed hawk would have to flap, but they're able to get onto thermals, and that basically it's kind of a temperature wind funnel, if you will. And the birds get into those thermals, and they're able to glide within those, and it helps to warm them and really get their temperatures up for the day so that they can go out and do some of that cleaning of the environment.
And how do they detect the carcasses of the things that they're going to eat? How far away can they detect those? And how do they go about doing that? They have some special adaptations for that.
They have amazing sense of smell compared with, for example, the black vultures, which often what people will see is that the black vultures will watch where the turkey vultures are going. Because the turkey vultures are going to smell it before anybody else is going to smell it. The eagles will often use that same strategy. And when the turkey vultures are, if they're in the air, and sometimes they'll circle together as they're getting ready to come down to a carcass, the black vultures will watch them, for example, and then they'll get in on the feeding, even though they didn't really find it. That's tough for us in if we're trying to raise chicks that have been brought into us, for example, with we get this time of year, you know, lots of chicks in nests, and they'll occasionally fall out. Or for the turkey vultures, I don't understand their strategy, but they will actually nest on the side of sometimes in interstates at right on the ground. So we have a pair of turkey vultures now that came in as chicks, and they were still little fluffy muppets, just white, you know, crazy hair when you've seen, you know, birds of prey chicks before. But they're what we do with all of the other birds that come in is we dress up in what's called a ghillie suit. For anybody that hunts, they'll know what that means. Mm-hmm. It's a hunting suit that basically camouflages you. And then we have a puppet that's either got an owl head or a hawk head, because primarily those are the species that we get in. When we got these turkey vulture chicks, we were like, what are we going to do? Because it doesn't matter if we use ghillie suits or puppets or whatever else, they can still smell humans. So me going and trying to give them food is going to be a human contact when they're that young. And often what can happen then is they will, quote, imprint on you as if you're mom, and they want to be with you for the rest of their lives. And of course, that doesn't work very well for their strategies in the wild. So we did everything possible that we could. We basically, unlike in some old movies about prisons where they'd slip the food under the door and then put a little hook under there to pull the metal plate back out or something like that, we did that. We tried not to go into the chamber. We used one of our adult turkey vultures, female turkey vulture, to see if she would have any maternal instincts. Sadly, she didn't. And, they had already been in hands of three different people before they got to us. And so we knew right off those birds were just not going to make it out in the wild. So they are very, very difficult to take in as chicks, for example, for that reason.
Wow. Would it be the same with condors? Because I know there's been, this active program of trying to breed condors and re-release them into the wild, for example, in Southern California, in the Cespe region, in Central California, in the Big Sur region, and then now in Northern California, the Yurok tribe is doing that. That's for the right. Klamath region.
Yeah. We were so excited to see that come on board. They don't have problems finding food. And whether or not they use the turkey vultures the same way that black vultures do, I'm not really sure. I haven't seen a study on that. We definitely know that that is a strategy of the black vulture. The reason that the California condor is in the trouble it's in and came to the brink of extinction in the early 1980s was for trophy hunting and also for being a pest and worrying farmers, and they would shoot them out of the sky. So in the early 80s, we were down to 35 California condors in the United States. And the only way that we could potentially protect the species from going extinct was to bring those 35 birds into captivity and create a captive breeding program. And so that captive breeding program began at San Diego Zoo and Wildlife Alliance. But San Diego, the LA Zoo, and the Portland Zoo, as well as the Grand Canyon team, all now work with condor populations, because thankfully, with our protections in place today, we have about 550 California condors. It's still not enough to take them out of captive breeding, but we are now seeing birds that were born in the wild starting to have their own chicks in the wild. And they're long-lived birds.
How long?
They could be, for example, in captivity, 50 to 80 years old.
Wow.
We have a turkey vulture right now at the California Raptor Center that's 45 years old. So unless they get shot out of the sky or hit by a car or any of the other many ways, sadly, that humans can impinge upon their environment, they do very well out there now. And so as a matter of fact, we've been, everybody was super excited that a condor spotted over Mount Diablo maybe a month ago now.
Ooh.
And we had not seen any of the southern population come this far up before. So gave a thrill to a lot of people, let me tell you, but it also brought their plight back, because they're not out of trouble. And it will only take maybe one disease, like highly pathogenic avian influenza, which killed 22 of our California condors, or other things like lead poisoning, which they still pick up from eating carcasses that have been shot with lead ammunition, to the point of poisoning them and killing them. So we are, most of those reasons for their deaths are really anthropogenic, meaning it's human-based.
We are going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the lives of vultures and condors with our guest, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, Michelle Hawkins. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our guest is Dr. Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, and we're talking about a very special and chronically underappreciated family of birds, the vultures. Let's talk some more about condors. I was watching a documentary about Patagonia the other day, and they were showing the magnificent Andean condors. They're such absolutely incredible flying machines. What kind of range do condors have compared to, like, say, turkey vultures?
Yeah, sure. Turkey vultures, their wingspan's smaller, and because there are more of them, they tend to stay in one place because they help each other out find food. We have a lot more than 550 turkey vultures in the state of California. So the Andean condor is really mostly in the Andes mountain range. And so, but that's the extent of the Andes mountain range. So Argentina, Peru, and probably, as you saw, down into Patagonia are these birds. And they're certainly, they are the largest of these birds in the Americas. They have, I think some say 10 to 11 foot wingspans, whereas our condors generally have about 9 foot wingspans and the turkey vulture 6 feet. So the condors stay in their areas and they look for food in their areas, and they are social and they will congregate together. But one of those reasons that they will do that is because U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service still provides carcasses to them. They'll put them out into areas where they're known to go feeding to make sure that that carcass is clean, meaning it doesn't have any lead ammunition in it.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the special adaptations that vultures, you know, turkey vultures specifically, since I see them out here feeding on dead things all the time, they must have some kind of adaptations to deal with, you know, eating meat that's gone, what we would call gone bad, you know, gone rancid or whatever, that you've got bacteria and stuff. Do they have special adaptations that allow them to eat that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, they smell really well. So for whatever reasons, you know, that's your food and that's going to be your happy smell. But they have, like I said, a sharpened beak, which is very similar to the raptors. They have kind of a very, very sharp point that allows them to kind of dig in. And they don't have plumage on their head. Their head's naked. And that is so that they can dig into that carcass and come back up. Whereas if you are an animal that does that and you have a lot of plumage, all of that blood, et cetera, things that are going to be inside of that carcass are going to get on the plumage, and it's going to add a lot of weight, and it's going to make flying a little bit more difficult. So for the turkey vultures, they have this adaptation to be able to get in there and let their heads dry pretty quickly so they can take off very quickly.
Do they have adaptations in their digestive system that allow them to eat, you know, meat that's would make us very sick?
Right now, there are some studies looking at the microbiome, i.e. the bacteria that they have in their GI systems, to see how different that is and why, you know, putrefying food that we would be afraid would give us some horrible, you know, GI infection doesn't cause that in them. And so that's really being looked at now, but that is across all of the vultures and condors that they're able to do that. In fact, condors that have come into captivity to be treated for lead poisoning, they will put out a rabbit the first day that the animal gets there And the animal will wait 4 or 5 days before they'll eat it. And of course, it was dead when it was put in. So yes, there have to be adaptations in their gut that allows this to happen. We're just not sure exactly what it is, because overall, their GI tract is similar to an eagle, similar to a red-tailed hawk. It's just not that much different. They have pretty, while they don't have talons, they can stand flat-footed, and their nails are pretty long, and that helps them to kind of dig in as well.
Well, you mentioned they're flying, and it's fascinating to watch them fly because they don't flap their wings a lot. They just soar and they catch the thermals. I'm wondering, yeah, you know, has anybody done some interesting studies on their flying, the aerodynamics of their flying that maybe apply to, you know, hang gliders and things like that?
Funny you should ask that question. But actually, right now, I have just started a collaboration with a colleague that's in aerospace engineering. And we are building a flight hall out at the California Raptor Center right now so that we can fly birds of prey. And we're talking about birds that have different niches in our environment that also have different wing morphologies and the way they utilize their wings. And we're going to fly them in this flight hall that has tons of videos in all these different places that will allow us to combine that, put it into three-dimensional video, and then we will be taking that to a 3D printer and then putting it in a wind tunnel and see how it behaves. And the reason for this is because certainly there's a lot of different ways that this could be used to inform on how uncrewed aerial vehicles, search it, for example, drones, may act out there. Drones can go up and down, side to side, you know, a little bit of maneuvering, but they really can't maneuver well. Even today, think about how many years ago it was that Jeff Bezos told us that they would be dropping our packages on our front porch with a drone, and it hasn't happened because the technology is just not there yet. So our flight hall is going to be the first in the United States that's going to allow us to look at a number of different birds that have very different wing styles and how they either flap, glide. We won't be able to soar, but we will have our turkey vultures that are imprinted because there's nothing the matter with their wings. We'll be flying them in there as well. And we're looking at different parts of the wing to see how that may be able to be used to make drones able to really do a lot more things than they can do now. And from my standpoint, of course, you know, I want to know what's in it for me. I'm sure the DOD, who has funded the flight hall, I'm sure that they have some very specific ideas of why they want them. But for us out in our world, you know, I foresee, for example, my colleagues were really lamenting how to get samples from killer whales and some other whales to find out what's in their respiratory tree. And they want to do cultures of their blowholes. This would allow for something like that, for example. Another for our health and well-being is at this point are the virus hunters that are out there hoping not to find the next big pandemic. And a lot of times those, you know, some of those diseases that have crossed into humans have come from bats. So going into a bat cave to collect samples, you have to get in a full Tyvek suit. You know, every part of you is covered and covered again to ensure that you don't pick up any disease. What about if we fly a drone in there and get those samples for you instead? And we can manipulate that drone in ways that we can move across and around round caves, you know, getting around different angles that maybe a traditional drone wouldn't be able to do. And then finally, bringing it home to me as a veterinarian, we're going to be able to use this to inform on how good our ways right now of determining that a bird has completed its rehabilitation and it's ready to go back out into the world, we, you know, think we have done the best job we can and we've released them. We don't have trackers on every bird. They're quite expensive. And so while we have what we consider a 60% release rate, we can't say that's a success rate. And so now we'll be able to utilize this flight haul to put these birds into before they're going to be released so that we can look at just how they're using their wings. And particularly, we get a lot of wing fractures in seeing how one wing and the other wing are interacting together. It's going to allow us to have so much more information than we do now for what I do, as well as informing on all these other things. So it's really translational, but it makes perfect sense because anybody who is flying anything knows that it's primarily fixed wing, and we want to find ways to not have that in the future.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, another behavior I see a lot with my neighborhood turkey vultures, and it always catches my eye, is they tend to stand up in their trees with their wings outstretched, especially like in the early morning. What are they doing there?
Oh, I absolutely love it. And seeing either turkey vultures doing it or condors on a ridge all together doing it, they're sunning themselves to warm their bodies up, because if they're cold, they're not going to be able to fly as effectively, and therefore they're not going to be able to get to their next meal as effectively. So they put their wings out and allow their entire body to be exposed, and particularly up kind of in, say, you know, your armpit area, there's areas for them that don't have as many feathers. And it allows that sun to get in quicker and increase their temperatures quicker. So yeah, they're out there and sunning themselves to get ready for their day.
I think I saw something recently that said that they also may be doing that for the ultraviolet light to be killing off some nasty bacteria. Have you ever heard anything about that?
There's a lot of stories for sure, but you know, where are they, you know, they don't really have a lot of nasty bacteria on their wings, right? Because when they're eating, they're folded in. So, you know, they're not going to bathe themselves usually, but, you know, they may have something on their legs or something on their head. But I don't know of any studies that have said that definitively. They do clean their own heads and everything, but not to the same degree as they do with their plumage. So that's not one that I know is entirely true yet, but it makes some sense. And there's other things as well that have been talked about, mites and lice that they sometimes have. If they get very, very hot, that'll kill them. But in terms of bacteria, I don't know that we've got the evidence yet.
If you're just joining us, we're examining the lives and roles of vultures and condors in nature with our guest, Michelle Hawkins, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with Michelle Hawkins, director of UC Davis's California Raptor Center, and we're examining the lives of some of nature's most fascinating, if somewhat unloved, birds, the vulture family. Let's talk a bit about their reproductive cycle. What are their mating and nesting habits like? Do they mate for life, or how often do they mate? And tell us a bit about, you know, how they bring up their young.
You know, a lot of what we thought we knew, we don't know. And, you know, every year that we get better ways to look at and detect these things, you know, the more we find that they may not be exactly the case. In the case of the California condor, it was thought they mated for life. And that if a mate died, that other animal may not go back out and look for and find another mate. And we found that in the last 10 to 15 years to just not be true. in turkey vultures. I don't think that that's true either. But the time, and for condors, they do nest high in the redwoods, whereas turkey vultures, like I said, they nest on the side of the road, or they nest in areas that are actually on the ground and not necessarily up in trees. So different strategies, you know, for being in different parts, I guess, of the environment in a way. The time to the chick hatching is about the same between different species. The bigger the species, the longer they're usually in the egg. But a difference is that condors do not become sexually active and reproducing until they're 7 or 8 years of age. So you can understand why, you know, going from 35 to 550 has taken so long. And then usually a chick will stay with the parents for 2 years so that those breeding pair will only have a chick at least every other year or every third year. But we found now with the loss of a mate for whatever reasons that many of these birds have found other mates. And especially for us here in the United States with our critically endangered California condor, you know, we were really happy to see that they decided their mourning period was over and they went back out there again to look for another mate.
Well, good for them. How long do the eggs take to gestate and hatch?
Yeah, around 45 days for the condors. I believe the turkey vultures are less than that. It might be more like 35 days.
And how many, you know, typically do they have?
One, yes. Wow. So they do not have a clutch the same way as hawks and eagles do. They have one at a time.
Wow, I wonder why that would be. That's interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of these things we try to get at and see. I think that it's because the growth pattern, the maturity, just a maturity of understanding the environment and how to go about finding food and being around your cohort, because the cohorts of condors that are in our four, now five different areas of California, they generally stay within that cohort. They don't, you know, venture out, except for our lone wolf guy there that wanted to have a little look at Mount Diablo a month or so ago. But usually, I think those are the reasons that their fecundity, you know, or egg laying is really reduced. And then you have to wait 7 or 8 years for them to get sexually mature and find a mate. I think with the turkey vultures, it's certainly less than that. Both turkey and black here in the United States, the chicks don't stay as long with the parents as the condors do. So there's just so many different strategies we don't understand sometimes as to why these things are.
Well, that's why we need people like you studying these things.
Yeah, I love studying them, let me tell you.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about their social lives. I rarely see just one turkey vulture. They always seem to be together. Tell us about their social lives. How social are they?
They are very social animals. So they will roost together in the same tree at night, as will the condors in some cases. And sadly, during the Caldor fire a few years ago, we lost 11 condors because they were all roosted in the same tree that burned. So, you know, at night, probably for security, but during the daytime, they are social eaters. They come together at the feast and they feast together. They will often go up and ride the thermals and soar on the thermals, which again, we think is partly of getting other temperatures up for different things. And they'll do that together. And I think there's some safety in numbers for them, for sure. And it helps for those youngsters that may stay with parents longer to learn from multiple different adults, if you will, so that they get the best out of that time until they're adults themselves. But they are very, very social animals in those ways.
And I've even seen, like, I think it was with some African vultures where, you know, they will go out, they will go and feed on a carcass that's, you know, just been recently killed by a predator, like, you know, a lion or a cheetah or whatever. And they must have some kinds of special strategies for dealing with those predators that they're hanging around with.
Yeah, and because there's certainly, there are images online, you know, as well as things in textbooks that have shown that they will often move over, you know, and let the predator come in and have one end of the carcass while they're working on the other end. Or they'll wait for the carnivore to finish its meal, go off somewhere to digest, and then they'll come in because maybe some of the things that they want to eat, you know, are more tasty bits to them than a mammalian, you know, predator. And like I said, the strategy of black vultures to pay attention to where the turkey vultures are going, and then they follow them to that carcass and they'll all eat on it together. One of my first memories here in California, I was working on I was doing some work with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they would go out every year to Round Valley, which is near Bishop, California, and do a roundup of the black-tailed deer down there to get population information, disease information, et cetera. And they would put a radio collar on each animal that they took data from. And one day after we had put the collar on one deer the day before, in the morning it had a mortality signal, which means that the animal has stopped moving for X number of hours. And so it's called a mortality signal. And we can then trace that because we, you know, they do have a transmitter on them now. And so we could trace them. And I went out with the biologist to try to find it because the radio collars are very expensive. And we wanted to retrieve it and try to see if there we could see why that animal succumbed one day after it had been, you know, in our hands. And as we came over this one hill out in the valley, there were at least 10 golden eagles and probably 10 turkey vultures on the carcass. And so we, you know, we get to the top of the hill and everybody takes off in a big flush.
Wow.
And, it was one of the most magnificent things I've ever seen.
Well, and such a great setting there in the Eastern Sierra the great Eastern escarpment of the Sierra. That must have been spectacular.
Yeah, growing up in North Carolina, and no offense, I love my home state, but yeah, you know, just seeing some of these things, those are definitely things that'll be imprinted, hopefully, in my brain for all of my life. But that was pretty amazing to me, and I didn't realize that the eagles would give up space for the scavengers, or, you know, push them off and say, just wait until I get finished with what I'm going to do.
Interesting. It also, it's something just, you know, fascinates me anecdotally anyway, when I'm driving around, I see a roadkill and I'll see the turkey vultures working at it. And then, you know, it's not very long, you know, a few days or whatever later, it's like, oh, it's all gone.
Yes. And that is, you know, why in the culture of India, as just an example, you know, with their cattle are sacred. And so when they die out there, they, you know, they allow natural processes to take that animal, and they feed the condors or vultures, whichever ones are in that particular area. So that was very saddening to us when we started seeing drops in the number of these birds in India and in some other Asian countries that have them. And now the African condors are in decline as well. And it's a little bit of a different story we're looking into. But what we found after a lot of trial and tribulation of trying to figure out why all of a sudden these condor and vulture populations were declining precipitously to the point that 80% of the Indian and Asian condor populations were decimated. It was because the veterinarians with a sick cattle gave the cattle an anti-inflammatory drug to make them feel better. But when the vultures ate the tissues, that anti-inflammatory was in the tissues, and it killed them. And it killed lots of them. And so it took us probably 5 years of a lot of, you know, research to finally figure out what it was. And it was a very specific drug. And once that was found, then we had to start looking at other drugs and find out, are they safe? And, you know, we had to try to do that in a safer space, which nobody wants to see an animal pass, but, you know, it's, and is one species different in how they're going to respond to that than another? But fortunately now, for this has been probably 15 years now, we've been looking into and trying to come up with alternatives so that these cattle get their relief from pain. Of course, we want to relieve suffering while allowing these animals to clean up the environment afterwards. And so finally, we've hit on a couple of things, but, you know, we've got to get that out there into all of these countries. And in some cases, those drugs weren't available in the countries. So we're doing more and more research to try to find that out. One of our colleagues in India has created a cell line of condor cells, and he can actually introduce some of these drugs into it, and he can see it kill the cells. So that has been incredibly useful to us, that if we, you know, in the petri dish versus in the living animal, that we don't want to be taking any chances with, because we've lost so many of them.
For people like me, just the general public listening to this, what are some things we can do to, you know, make sure that we protect these valuable parts of our ecosystem here in the Western United States?
Help educate in several different ways. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has started a lot of educational programs trying to let the general public know, you know, why we continue to have setbacks in the condor populations, for example. What we tell people is, you know, one of the big things is lead poisoning. And when a bullet penetrates an animal that's still alive, it shatters into a million pieces if you look at an X-ray of that animal. But the person that's that hunter may not see that. So the turkey vultures, they are shot. That is another problem between turkey vultures, and not as much condors anymore, because everybody knows they're critically endangered. Nobody wants to be that person. But with the turkey vultures, they will still be shot, or things might be used in those areas that wouldn't have condors. So, you know, we are trying to have ammunition switches and giving copper ammunition to hunters and ask them to use that instead of lead, because that doesn't split up the way that lead does. And I think the other major thing for just the general public is to realize that these animals do us a major service by cleaning up the environment, getting rid of all that roadkill. You know, it's like you said, it's gone in no time flat. And helping to educate the next generation coming up so that they see the many different ways these animals help us and are part of our environment. They were here before we were, and we should protect them. And when we start, now that we're getting there compared to where we were a few decades ago, I think that we'll finally, you know, get these animals to not have such a bad rap as they had before, and to hopefully stop poisoning them, because we can treat them, but if we get them too late, it is too late.
Yeah. And like you said, they provide such a great service. There's just, I can't think of any reason why anybody would want to shoot turkey vultures. They don't kill your cattle or your sheep or anything like that. They just clean up the things that have already been killed.
But they are, you know, they're called a raptor. So maybe that particular person, that particular farmer, doesn't know that they are not killing something to eat it. So again, education anywhere we can to help the general public to understand these animals, their natural biology and all of the amazing things they do for us to try to do a better job of protecting them for the future.
Well, I just, Michelle Hawkins, it's just been a joy to talk to you. It's so fascinating to learn about vultures and condors, and I hope people appreciate them a lot more. The origin of my interest came the other day. It was just kind of in a whimsical way. I was thinking about the late Neil Armstrong and his love of gliders and sailplanes. And I was watching the turkey vultures flying overhead, and I just thought to myself, you know, Neil would probably really enjoy just watching these birds sail around. And then I got to thinking, it's like, I don't know very much about these birds. I want to learn more. So thanks for helping me and all of us to learn more about them.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to our guest, director of the California Raptor Center at UC Davis, Michelle Hawkins. You can learn more about their work at crc.vetmed.ucdavis.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.